street told me that. I'm poor, and I want to be poor. I'll be poor all my life. My mother told me so when she was dying. I'll work. I don't want to wear this dress.
I'll buy you another one tomorrow, and I'll get your books. You shall stay with me. I won't send you away to any unless you want to go. Don't worry yourself.
I'll be a work girl.
Very well, very well. Only be quiet. Lie down, go to sleep. But the poor child burst into tears. By degrees, her tears passed to sobs. I didn't know what to do with her. I offered her water and moistened her temples and her hand. At last, she sank on the sofa completely exhausted, and she was overcome by feverish shivering. I wrapped her up in what I could find, and she fell into an uneasy sleep, starting and waking up continually. Though I had not walked far that day, I was awfully tired, and I decided to go to bed as early as possible. Tormenting doubts swarmed in my brain. I foresaw that I should have a lot of trouble with this child, but my chief anxiety was about Natasha and her troubles. Altogether, as I remember now, I have rarely been in a mood of such deep dejection as when I fell asleep that unhappy night. Chapter 9. I waked up late, at 10 o'clock in the morning, feeling ill. I felt giddy and my head was aching. I glanced towards Alina's bed. The bed was empty. At the same moment, from my little room on the right, sounds reached me as though someone were sweeping with a broom. I went to look. Elena had a broom in her hand, and holding up her smart dress which she had kept on ever since that evening, she was sweeping the floor. The wood for the stove was piled up in the corner. The table had been scrubbed, the kettle had been cleaned. In a word, Elena was doing the housework. "Listen, Elena," I cried. "Who wants you to sweep the floor? I don't wish it. You're ill. Have you come here to be a drudge for me?"
"Who is going to sweep the floor here?"
she answered, drawing herself up and looking straight at me.
"I'm not ill now."
"But I didn't take you to make you work, Elena. You seem to be afraid I shall scold you like Madame Pupnov for living with me for nothing. And where did you get that horrid broom?" "I had no broom," I added, looking at her in wonder.
"It's my broom. I brought it here myself. I used to sweep the floor here for Grandfather, too. And the broom's been lying here ever since under the stove."
I went back to the other room, musing. Perhaps I may have been in error, but it seemed to me that she felt oppressed by my hospitality, and that she wanted in every possible way to show me that she was doing something for her living. What an embittered character, if so, I thought. 2 minutes later she came in, and without a word sat down on the sofa in the same place as yesterday, looking inquisitively at me. Meanwhile, I boiled the kettle, made the tea, poured out a cup for her, and handed it her with a slice of white bread. She took it in silence and without opposition. She had had nothing for 24 hours. "See, you've dirtied your pretty dress with that broom," I said, noticing a streak of dirt on her skirt. She looked down, and suddenly, to my intense astonishment, she put down her cup, and, apparently calm and composed, she picked up a breadth of the muslin skirt in both hands, and with one rip tore it from top to bottom. When she had done this, she raised her stubborn, flashing eyes to me in silence. Her face was pale. "What are you about, Elena?" I cried, feeling sure the child was mad.
"It's a horrid dress,"
she cried, almost gasping with excitement.
"Why do you say it's a nice dress? I don't want to wear it,"
she cried suddenly, jumping up from her place.
"I'll tear it up. I didn't ask her to dress me up. She did it herself by force. I've torn one dress already. I'll tear this one. I'll tear it. I'll tear it. I'll tear it."
And she fell upon her luckless dress with fury. In one moment she had torn it almost into rags. When she had finished, she was so pale she could hardly stand. I looked with surprise at such rage. She looked at me with a defiant air, as though I too had somehow offended her. But I knew not what to do. I made up my mind to buy her a new dress that morning. This wild, embittered little creature must be tamed by kindness. She looked as though she had never met anyone kind. If once already, in spite of severe punishment, she had torn another similar dress to rags, with what fury she must look on this one now, when it recalled to her those awful moments. In Tolkuchi Market one could buy a good, plain dress very cheaply. Unfortunately, at that moment I had scarcely any money. But as I went to bed the night before, I had made up my mind to go that morning to a place where I had hopes of getting some. It was fortunately not far from the market. I took my hat. Elena watched me intently, as though expecting something.
"Are you going to lock me in again?"
she asked, when I took up the key to lock the door behind me, as I had done the day before, and the day before that. "My dear," I said, going up to her, "don't be angry at that. I lock the door because someone might come. You are ill, and you'd perhaps be frightened. And there's no knowing who might not come. Perhaps Bubnov might take it into her head to..." I said this on purpose. I locked her in because I didn't trust her. I was afraid that she might suddenly take it into her head to leave me. I determined to be cautious for a time. Elena said nothing, and I locked her in again. I knew a publisher who had been for the last 12 years bringing out a compilation in many volumes. I often used to get work from him when I was obliged to make money somehow. He paid regularly. I applied to him, and he gave me 25 rubles in advance, engaging me to compile an article by the end of the week. But I hoped to pick up time on my novel. I often did this when it came to the last necessity. Having got the money, I set off to the market. There I soon found an old woman I knew who sold old clothes of all sorts. I gave her Elena's size approximately, and she instantly picked me out a light-colored cotton dress, priced extremely cheaply, though it was quite strong and had not been washed more than once. While I was about it, I took a neckerchief too. As I paid for them, I reflected that Elena would need a coat, mantle, or something of that kind. It was cold weather, and she had absolutely nothing. But I put off that purchase for another time. Elena was so proud and ready to take offense. Goodness knows, I thought, how she'll take this dress, even though I purposely picked out the most ordinary garment, as plain and unattractive as possible. I did, however, buy her 2 pairs of thread stockings and 1 pair of woolen. Those I could give her on the ground that she was ill, and that it was cold in the room. She would need underclothes, too. But all that I left till I should get to know her better. Then I bought some old curtains for the bed. They were necessary, and might be a great satisfaction to Elena. With all these things, I returned home at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. My key turned almost noiselessly in the lock, so that Elena did not at once hear me come in. I noticed that she was standing at the table, turning over my books and papers. Hearing me, she hurriedly closed the book she was reading and moved away from the table, flushing all over. I glanced at the book. It was my first novel, which had been republished in book form and had my name on the title page.
"Someone knocked here while you were away,"
she said, in a tone which seemed to taunt me for having locked her in. "Wasn't it the doctor?" I said. "Didn't you call to him, Elena?"
"No."
I made no answer, but took my parcel, untied it, and took out the dress I had bought. "Here, Elena, my dear," I said, going up to her. "You can't go about in such rags as you've got on now. So I've bought you a dress, an everyday one, very cheap. So there's no need for you to worry about it. It only cost 1 ruble 20 kopecks. Wear it with my best wishes." I put the dress down beside her. She flushed crimson and looked at me for some time with open eyes. She was extremely surprised, and at the same time it seemed to me that she was horribly ashamed for some reason. But there was a light of something soft and tender in her eyes. Seeing that she said nothing, I turned away to the table. What I had done had evidently impressed her, but she controlled herself with an effort and sat with her eyes cast down. My head was going round and aching more and more. The fresh air had done me no good. Meanwhile, I had to go to Natasha's. My anxiety about her was no less than yesterday. On the contrary, it kept growing more and more. Suddenly, I fancied that Elena called me. I turned to her.
"Don't lock me in when you go out,"
she said, looking away and picking at the border of the sofa, as though she were entirely absorbed in doing so.
"I will not go away from you."
"Very well, Elena, I agree. But what if some stranger comes? There's no knowing who may."
"Then leave me the key, and I'll lock myself in, and if they knock, I shall say not at home."
And she looked slyly at me, as much as to say, "See how simply that's done."
"Who washes your clothes?"
she asked suddenly, before I had had time to answer her. "There's a woman here in this house."
"I know how to wash clothes. And where did you get the food yesterday?"
"At a restaurant."
"I know how to cook, too. I will do your cooking."
That will do, Elena. What can you know about cooking? You're talking nonsense. Elena looked down and was silent. She was evidently wounded at my remark. 10 minutes at least passed. We were both silent.
Soup,
she said suddenly, without raising her head. What about soup? What soup? I asked, surprised.
I can make soup. I used to make it for Mother when she was ill. I used to go to market, too.
See, Elena, just see how proud you are, I said, going up to her and sitting down beside her on the sofa. I treat you as my heart prompts me. You are all alone, without relations and unhappy. I want to help you. You'd help me in the same way if I were in trouble. But you won't look at it like that, and it's disagreeable to you to take the smallest present from me. You want to repay it at once, to pay for it by work, as though I were Madame Bubnov and would taunt you with it. If that is so, it's a shame, Elena. She made no answer. Her lips quivered. I believe she wanted to say something, but she controlled herself and was silent. I got up to go to Natasha. That time I left Elena the key, begging her if anybody should come and knock, to call out and ask who was there. I felt perfectly sure that something dreadful was happening to Natasha, and that she was keeping it dark from me for the time, as she had done more than once before. I resolved in any case to look in only for one moment, for fear of irritating her by my persistence. And it turned out I was right. She met me again with a look of harsh displeasure. I ought to have left her at once, but my legs were giving way under me. I've only come for a minute, Natasha, I began, to ask your advice what I'm to do with my visitor. And I began briefly telling her all about Elena. Natasha listened to me in silence.
I don't know what to advise you, Vanya, she said. Everything shows that she's a very strange little creature. Perhaps she has been dreadfully ill-treated and frightened. Give her time to get well, anyway. You think of my people for her.
She keeps saying that she won't go anywhere away from me. And goodness knows how they'll take her, so I don't know what to do. Well, tell me, dear, how you are. You didn't seem quite well yesterday, I said timidly.
Yes, my head aches rather today, too,
she answered absent-mindedly.
Haven't you seen any of our people?
No, I shall go tomorrow. Tomorrow's Saturday, you know.
Well, what of it?
The prince is coming in the evening.
Well, I've not forgotten.
No, I only... She stood still, exactly opposite me, and looked for a long time intently into my face. There was a look of determination, of obstinacy in her eyes, something feverish and wrathful.
Look here, Vanya, she said. Be kind. Go away. You worry me.
I got up from my chair and looked at her, unutterably astonished. Natasha, dear, what's the matter? What has happened? I cried in alarm.
Nothing's happened. You'll know all about it tomorrow, but now I want to be alone. Do you hear, Vanya? Go away at once. I can't bear to look at you.
But tell me, at least.
You'll know all about it tomorrow. Oh, my God, are you going?
I went out. I was so overcome that I hardly knew what I was doing. Mavra started out into the passage to meet me.
Why is she angry?
She asked me.
I'm afraid to go near her.
But what's the matter with her?
Why, our young gentleman hasn't shown his nose here for the last 3 days.
3 days? I repeated in amazement. Why, she told me yesterday that he had been here in the morning and was coming again in the evening.
She did. He never came near us in the morning. I tell you, we haven't set eyes on him for 3 days. You don't say she told you yesterday that he'd been in the morning?
Yes, she said so.
Well,
said Mavra, musing,
it must have cut her to the quick if she won't own it even to you. Well, he's a pretty one.
But what does it mean? I cried.
It means I don't know what to do with her,
said Mavra, throwing up her hands.
She was sending me to him yesterday, but twice she turned me back as I was starting, and today she won't even speak to me. If only you could see him. I daren't leave her now.
I rushed down the staircase beside myself.
Will you be here this evening?
Mavra called after me. We'll see then, I called up to her. I may just run into you to ask how she is. If only I'm alive myself. I really felt as though something had struck me to the very heart. Chapter 10. I went straight to Alyosha's. He lived with his father in Little Morskaya. Prince Valkovsky had a rather large flat, though he lived alone. Alyosha had 2 splendid rooms in the flat. I had very rarely been to see him, only once before, I believe, in fact. He had come to see me much oftener, especially at first, during the early period of his connection with Natasha. He was not at home. I went straight to his rooms and wrote him the following note. "Alyosha, you seem to have gone out of your mind. As on Tuesday evening your father himself asked Natasha to do you the honor of becoming your wife, and you were delighted at his doing so, as I saw myself, you must admit that your behavior is somewhat strange. Do you know what you are doing to Natasha? In any case, this note will remind you that your behavior towards your future wife is unworthy and frivolous in the extreme. I am very well aware that I have no right to lecture you, but I don't care about that in the least. P.S. She knows nothing about this letter, and in fact, it was not she who told me about you." I sealed up the letter and left it on his table. In answer to my question, the servant said that Alexei Petrovich was hardly ever at home, and that he would not be back now till the small hours of the morning. I could hardly get home. I was overcome with giddiness, and my legs were weak and trembling. My door was open. Nikolai Sergeyevich Ichmenyev was sitting waiting for me. He was sitting at the table watching Elena in silent wonder, and she, too, was watching him with no less wonder, though she was obstinately silent. To be sure, I thought, he must think her queer.
"Well, my boy, I've been waiting for you for a good hour, and I must confess I had never expected to find things like this,"
he went on, looking round the room with a scarcely perceptible sign towards Elena. His face expressed his astonishment. But looking at him more closely, I noticed in him signs of agitation and distress. His face was paler than usual.
Sit down,"
he said, with a preoccupied and anxious air.
"I've come round to you in a hurry. I've something to say to you. But what's the matter? You don't look yourself."
"I'm not well. I've been giddy all day."
"Well, mind, you mustn't neglect that. Have you caught cold or what?"
"No, it's simply a nervous attack. I sometimes have them. But aren't you unwell?"
"No, no, it's nothing. It's excitement. I've something to say. Sit down."
I moved a chair over and sat down at the table facing him. The old man bent forward to me and said in a half whisper,
"Mind, don't look at her, but seem as though we were speaking of something else. What sort of visitor is this you've got here?"
"I'll explain to you afterwards, Nikolai Sergeyevich. This poor girl is absolutely alone in the world. She's the grandchild of that old smith who used to live here and died at the confectioner's."
"Ah, so you had a grandchild. Well, my boy, she's a queer little thing. How she stares, how she stares. I tell you plainly, if you hadn't come in, I couldn't have stood it another 5 minutes. She would hardly open the door, and all this time not a word. It's quite uncanny. She's not like a human being. But how did she come here? I suppose she came to see her grandfather, not knowing he was died."
"Yes, she has been very unfortunate. The old man thought of her when he was dying."
She seems to take after her grandfather. You'll tell me all about that later. Perhaps one could help her somehow, in some way, if she's so unfortunate. But now, my boy, can't you tell her to go away, for I want to talk to you of something serious."
"But she's nowhere to go. She's living here." I explained in a few words, as far as I could, adding that he could speak before her, that she was only a child.
"To be sure, she's a child. But you have surprised me, my boy. She's staying with you. Good heavens!"
And the old man looked at her again in amazement. Elena, feeling that we were talking about her, sat silent with her head bent, picking at the edge of the sofa with her fingers. She had already had time to put on her new dress, which fitted her perfectly. Her hair had been brushed more carefully than usual, perhaps in honor of the new dress. Altogether, if it had not been for the strange wildness of her expression, she would have been a very pretty child.
"Short and clear, that's what I have to tell you,"
the old man began again.
"It's a long business, an important business."
He sat looking down with a grave and meditative air, and in spite of his haste and his short and clear, he could find no words to begin. "What's coming?" I wondered.
"Do you know, Vanya, I've come to you to ask a very great favor. But first, as I realize now myself, I must explain to you certain circumstances, very delicate circumstances."
He cleared his throat and stole a look at me, looked and flushed red, flushed and was angry with himself for his awkwardness. He was angry and pressed on.
"Well, what is there to explain? You understand yourself. The long and short of it is, I'm challenging Prince Valkovsky to a duel, and I beg you to make the arrangements and be my second.
I fell back in my chair and gazed at him, beside myself with astonishment.
"Well, what are you staring at? I've not gone out of my mind."
"But, excuse me, Nikolai Sergeyitch, on what pretext? With what object? And, in fact, how is it possible?"
"Pretext? Object?"
cried the old man.
"That's good."
"Very well, very well. I know what you'll say, but what good will you do by your action? What will be gained by the duel? I must own, I don't understand it."
"I thought you wouldn't understand. Listen, our lawsuit over, that is, it will be over in a few days. There are only a few formalities to come. I have lost the case. I have to pay 10,000. That's the decree of the court. Ichmenyevka is the security for it. So now this base man is secure of his money, and giving up Ichmenyevka, I have paid him the damages and become a free man. Now I can hold up my head and say, 'You've been insulting me one way and another, honored prince, for the last 2 years. You have sullied my name and the honor of my family, and I have been obliged to bear all this.' I could not then challenge you to a duel. You'd have said openly then, 'You cunning fellow, you want to kill me in order not to pay me the money which you foresee you'll be sentenced to pay sooner or later. No, first let's see how the case ends, and then you can challenge me. Now, honored prince, the case is settled, you are secure, so now there are no difficulties, and so now will you be pleased to meet me at the barrier. That's what I have to say to you. What, to your thinking, haven't I the right to avenge myself for everything? For everything?"
His eyes glittered. I looked at him for a long time without speaking. I wanted to penetrate to his secret thought. "Listen, Nikolai Sergeyitch," I said at last, making up my mind to speak out on the real point, without which we could not understand each other. "Can you be perfectly open with me?"
"I can,"
he answered firmly. "Tell me plainly. Is it only the feeling of revenge that prompts you to challenge him, or have you other objects in view?"
"Vanya,"
he answered,
"you know that I allow no one to touch on certain points with me, but I'll make an exception in the present case. For you, with your clear insight, have seen at once that we can't avoid the point. Yes, I have another aim. That aim is to save my lost daughter and to rescue her from the path of ruin to which recent events are driving her now."
"But how will you save her by this duel? That's the question."
"By hindering all that is being plotted among them now. Listen, don't imagine that I'm actuated by fatherly tenderness or any weakness of that sort. All that's nonsense. I don't display my inmost heart to anyone. Even you don't know it. My daughter has abandoned me, has left my house with a lover, and I have cast her out of my heart. I cast her out once for all that very evening, you remember? If you have seen me sobbing over her portrait, it doesn't follow that I want to forgive her. I did not forgive her then. I wept for my lost happiness, for my vain dreams, but not for her as she is now. I often weep, perhaps. I'm not ashamed to own it, just as I'm not ashamed to own that I once loved my child more than anything on earth. All this seems to belie my conduct now. You may say to me, 'If it's so, if you are indifferent to the fate of her whom you no longer look on as a daughter, why do you interfere in what they are plotting there?' I answer, in the first place, that I don't want to let that base and crafty man triumph, and secondly, from a common feeling of humanity. If she's no longer my daughter, she's a weak creature, defenseless and deceived, who is being still more deceived, that she may be utterly ruined. I can't meddle directly, but indirectly by a duel I can. If I'm killed or my blood is shed, surely she won't step over our barrier, perhaps over my corpse, and stand at the altar beside the son of my murderer, like the daughter of that king, do you remember, in the book you learnt to read out of, who rode in her chariot over her father's body. And besides, if it comes to a duel, our princes won't care for the marriage themselves. In short, I don't want that marriage, and I'll do everything I can to prevent it. Do you understand me now?"
"No. If you wish Natasha well, how can you make up your mind to hinder her marriage? That is, the one thing that can establish her good name. She has all her life before her. She will have need of her good name."
"She ought to spit on the opinion of the world. That's how she ought to look at it. She ought to realize that the greatest disgrace of all for her lies in that marriage, in being connected with those vile people, with that paltry society. A noble pride. That should be her answer to the world. Then, perhaps, I might consent to hold out a hand to her, and then we would see who dared cry shame on my child."
Such desperate idealism amazed me, but I saw at once that he was not himself and was speaking in anger. "That's too idealistic," I answered, "and therefore cruel. You're demanding of her a strength which perhaps you did not give her at her birth. Do you suppose that she is consenting to this marriage because she wants to be a princess? Why, she's in love. It's passion. It's fate. You expect of her a contempt for public opinion, while you bow down before it yourself. The prince has insulted you, has publicly accused you of a base scheme to ally yourself with his princely house, and now you are reasoning that if she refuses them now after a formal offer of marriage from their side, it will, of course, be the fullest and plainest refutation of the old calumny. That's what you will gain by it. You are deferring to the opinion of the prince himself, and you're struggling to make him recognize his mistake. You're longing to turn him into derision, to revenge yourself on him, and for that you will sacrifice your daughter's happiness. Isn't that egoism? The old man sat gloomy and frowning, and for a long time he answered not a word.
You're unjust to me, Vanya,
he said at last, and a tear glistened on his eyelashes.
I swear you are unjust. But let us leave that. I can't turn my heart inside out before you,
he went on, getting up and taking his hat.
One thing I will say. You spoke just now of my daughter's happiness. I have absolutely and literally no faith in that happiness. Besides which, the marriage will never come off, apart from my interference.
How so? What makes you think so? Perhaps you know something, I cried with curiosity.
No, I know nothing special. But that cursed fox can never have brought himself to such a thing. It's all nonsense, all a trap. I'm convinced of that, and mark my words, it will turn out so. And secondly, even if this marriage did take place, which could only happen if that scoundrel has some special, mysterious interests to be served by it, interests which no one knows anything about, and I'm utterly at a loss to understand, tell me, ask your own heart, will she be happy in that marriage? Taunts, humiliations, with the partner of her life a wretched boy who is weary of her love already, and who will begin to neglect her, insult her, and humiliate her as soon as he is married. At the same time, her own passion growing stronger as his grows cooler. Jealousy, tortures, hell, divorce, perhaps crime itself. No, Vanya. If you're all working for that end, and you have a hand in it, you'll have to answer to God for it. I warn you, though it will be too late then. Goodbye.
I stopped him. Listen, Nikolai Sergeyich. Let us decide to wait a bit. Let me assure you that more than one pair of eyes is watching over this affair. And perhaps it will be settled out of itself in the best possible way without violence and artificial interference, such as a duel, for instance. Time is the very best arbiter. And finally, let me tell you, your whole plan is utterly impossible. Could you for a moment suppose that Prince Valkovsky would accept your challenge?
Not accept it? What do you mean by that?
I swear he wouldn't. And believe me, he'd find a perfectly satisfactory way out of it. He would do it all with pedantic dignity, and meanwhile you would be an object of derision.
Upon my word, my boy, upon my word, you simply overwhelm me. How could he refuse to accept it? No, Vanya, you're simply a romancer, a regular romancer. Why do you suppose there is anything unbecoming in his fighting me? I'm just as good as he is. I'm an old man, an insulted father. You're a Russian author, and therefore also a respectable person. You can be second, and I can't make out what more you want.
Well, you'll see. He'll bring forward such excuses that you'll be the first to see that it will be utterly impossible for you to fight him.
Very well, my friend. Have it your own way. Wait, for a certain time, that is. We'll see what time will do. But one thing, my dear, give me your word of honor that you'll not speak of this conversation there, nor to Anna Andreevna.
I promise.
Do me another favor, Vanya. Never begin upon the subject again.
Very well. I promise.
And one more request. I know, my dear, that it's dull for you, perhaps, but come and see us as often as ever you can. My poor Anna Andreevna is so fond of you, and she's so wretched without you. You understand, Vanya?
And he pressed my hand warmly. I promised him with all my heart.
And now, Vanya, the last delicate question. Have you any money?
Money? I repeated with surprise.
Yes.
And the old man flushed and looked down.
I look at you, my boy, at your lodgings. At your circumstances, and when I think that you may have other outside expenses, and that you may have them just now, then, here, my boy, 150 rubles as a first instalment.
150? As a first instalment? And you've just lost your case?
Vanya, I see you didn't understand me at all. You may have exceptional calls on you, understand that. In some cases, money may help to an independent position, an independent decision. Perhaps you don't need it now, but won't you need it for something in the future? In any case, I shall leave it with you. It's all I've been able to get together. If you don't spend it, you can give it back. And now, goodbye. My God, how pale you are. Why, you're quite ill.
I took the money without protest. It was quite clear why he left it with me. I can scarcely stand up, I answered.
You must take care of yourself, Vanya, darling. Don't go out today. I shall tell Anna Andreevna what a state you're in. Oughtn't you to have a doctor? I'll see how you are tomorrow. I'll try my best to come, anyway, if only I can drag my legs along myself. Now, you'd better lie down. Well, goodbye. Goodbye, little girl. She's turned her back. Listen, my dear, here are another 5 rubles. That's for the child, but don't tell her I gave it her. Simply spend it for her. Get her some shoes or underclothes. She must need all sorts of things. Goodbye, my dear.
I went down to the gate with him. I had to ask the porter to go out to get some food for me. Elena had had no dinner. Chapter 11. But as soon as I came in, again I felt my head going round and fell down in the middle of the room. I remember nothing but Elena's shriek. She clasped her hands and flew to support me. That is the last moment that remains in my memory. When I regained consciousness, I found myself in bed. Elena told me later on that, with the help of the porter who came in with some eatables, she had carried me to the sofa. I woke up several times and always saw Elena's compassionate and anxious little face leaning over me. But I remember all this as in a dream, as through a mist, and the sweet face of the poor child came to me in glimpses through my stupor like a vision, like a picture. She brought me something to drink, arranged my bedclothes, or sat looking at me with a distressed and frightened face, and smoothing my hair with her fingers. Once I remember her gentle kiss on my face. Another time, suddenly waking up in the night, by the light of the smouldering candle that had been set on a little table by my bedside, I saw Elena lying with her face on my pillow, with her warm cheek resting on her hand, and her pale lips half parted in an uneasy sleep. But it was only early next morning that I fully regained consciousness. The candle had completely burnt out. The vivid rosy beams of early sunrise were already playing on the wall. Elena was sitting at the table asleep, with her tired little head pillowed on her left arm, and I remember I gazed a long time at her childish face, full, even in sleep, of an unchildlike sadness and a sort of strange, sickly beauty. It was pale, with long arrowy eyelashes lying on the thin cheeks, and pitch-black hair that fell thick and heavy in a careless knot on one side. Her other arm lay on my pillow. Very softly I kissed that thin little arm. But the poor child did not wake, though there was a faint glimmer of a smile on her pale lips. I went on gazing at her, and so quietly fell into a sound, healing sleep. This time I slept almost till midday. When I woke up, I felt almost well again. A feeling of weakness and heaviness in my limbs was the only trace left of my illness. I had had such sudden nervous attacks before. I knew them very well. The attack generally passed off within 24 hours, though the symptoms were acute and violent for that time. It was nearly midday. The first thing I saw was the curtain I had bought the day before, which was hanging on a string across the corner. Elena had arranged it, screening off the corner as a separate room for herself. She was sitting before the stove, boiling the kettle. Noticing that I was awake, she smiled cheerfully and at once came up to me. "My dear," I said, taking her hand, "you've been looking after me all night. I didn't know you were so kind."
"And how do you know I've been looking after you? Perhaps I've been asleep all night,"
she said, looking at me with shy and good-humoured slyness, and at the same time flushing shamefacedly at her own words. "I woke up and saw you. You only fell asleep at daybreak."
"Would you like some tea?"
she interrupted, as though feeling it difficult to continue the conversation, as all delicately modest and sternly truthful people are apt to when they are praised. "I should," I answered, "but did you have any dinner yesterday?"
"I had no dinner, but I had some supper. The porter brought it. But don't you talk. Lie still. You're not quite well yet,"
she added, bringing me some tea and sitting down on my bed. "Lie still, indeed. I will lie still, though till it gets dark, and then I'm going out. I really must, Linotchka."
"Oh, you must you? Who is it you're going to see? Not the gentleman who was here yesterday?"
"No, I'm not going to him."
"Well, I'm glad you're not. It was he upset you yesterday. To his daughter, then?"
What do you know about his daughter?
I heard all you said yesterday,
she answered, looking down. Her face clouded over. She frowned.
He's a horrid old man,
she added. You know nothing about him. On the contrary, he's a very kind man.
No, no, he's wicked. I heard,
she said with conviction. Why, what did you hear?
He won't forgive his daughter.
But he loves her. She has behaved badly to him, and he is anxious and worried about her.
Why doesn't he forgive her? If he does forgive her now, she shouldn't go back to him.
How so? Why not?
Because he doesn't deserve that she should love him,
she answered hotly.
Let her leave him forever, and let her go begging, and let him see his daughter begging and be miserable.
Her eyes flashed and her cheeks glowed. There must be something behind her words, I thought.
Was it to his home you meant to send me?
She added after a pause. Yes, Elena.
No, I'd better get a place as a servant.
Ah, how wrong is all that you're saying, Lenotchka. And what nonsense. Who would take you as a servant?
Any peasant,
she answered impatiently, looking more and more downcast. She was evidently hot-tempered. A peasant doesn't want a girl like you to work for him, I said, laughing.
Well, a gentleman's family, then.
You live in a gentleman's family, with your temper.
Yes.
The more irritated she became, the more abrupt were her answers. But you'd never stand it.
Yes, I would. They'd scold me, but I'd say nothing on purpose. They'd beat me, but I wouldn't speak. I wouldn't speak. Let them beat me. I wouldn't cry for anything. That would annoy them even more if I didn't cry.
Really, Elena? What bitterness, and how proud you are. You must have seen a lot of trouble. I got up and went to my big table. Elena remained on the sofa, looking dreamily at the floor and picking at the edge of the sofa. She did not speak. I wondered whether she were angry at what I had said. Standing by the table, I mechanically opened the books I had brought the day before for the compilation, and by degrees I became absorbed in them. It often happens to me that I go and open a book to look up something, and go on reading so that I forget everything.
What are you always writing?
Elena asked with a timid smile, coming quietly to the table. All sorts of things, Lenotchka. They give me money for it.
Petitions?
No, not petitions. And I explained to her as far as I could that I wrote all sorts of stories about different people, and that out of them were made books that are called novels. She listened with great curiosity.
Is it all true, what you write?
No, I make it up.
Why do you write what isn't true?
Why, here, read it. You see this book? You've looked at it already. You can read, can't you?
Yes.
Well, you'll see then. I wrote this book.
You? I'll read it.
She was evidently longing to say something, but found it difficult and was in great excitement. Something lay hidden under her questions.
And are you paid much for this?
She asked at last. It's as it happens. Sometimes a lot, sometimes nothing, because the work doesn't come off. It's difficult work, Lenotchka.
Then you're not rich?
No, not rich.
Then I shall work and help you.
She glanced at me quickly, flushed, dropped her eyes, and taking two steps towards me, suddenly threw her arms round me and pressed her face tightly against my breast. I looked at her with amazement.
I love you. I'm not proud,
she said.
You said I was proud yesterday. No, no, I'm not like that. I love you. You are the only person who cares for me.
But her tears choked her. A minute later they burst out with as much violence as the day before. She fell on her knees before me, kissed my hands, my feet.
You care for me,
she repeated.
You're the only one, the only one.
She embraced my knees convulsively. All the feeling which she had repressed for so long broke out at once in an uncontrollable outburst, and I understood the strange stubbornness of a heart that for a while shrinkingly masked its feeling, the more harshly, the more stubbornly, as the need for expression and utterance grew stronger, till the inevitable outburst came, when the whole being forgot itself and gave itself up to the craving for love, to gratitude, to affection, and to tears. She sobbed till she became hysterical. With an effort, I loosened her arms, lifted her up, and carried her to the sofa. For a long time she went on sobbing, hiding her face in the pillow as though ashamed to look at me. But she held my hand tight and kept it pressed to her heart. By degrees she grew calmer, but still did not raise her face to me. Twice her eyes flitted over my face, and there was a great softness and a sort of timorous and shrinking emotion in them. At last she flushed and smiled. "Are you better?" I asked. "My sensitive little Lenotchka, my sick little child."
"Not Lenotchka, no,"
she whispered, still hiding her face from me. "Not Lenotchka? What then?"
"Nelly."
"Nelly? Why must it be Nelly? If you like. It's a very pretty name. I'll call you so if that's what you wish."
"That's what Mother called me. And no one else ever called me that, no one but she. And I would not have anyone call me so but Mother. But you call me so. I want you to. I will always love you, always."
A loving and proud little heart, I thought. And how long it has taken me to win the right to call you Nelly. But now I knew her heart was gained forever. "Nelly, listen," I said, as soon as she was calmer. "You say that no one has ever loved you but your mother. Is it true your grandfather didn't love you?"
"No, he didn't."
"Yet you cried for him. Do you remember, here on the stairs?" For a minute she did not speak.
"No, he didn't love me. He was wicked."
A look of pain came into her face. "But we mustn't judge him too harshly, Nelly. I think he had grown quite childish with age. He seemed out of his mind when he died. I told you how he died."
"Yes, but he had only begun to be quite forgetful in the last month. He would sit here all day long, and if I didn't come to him, he would sit on for 2 or 3 days without eating or drinking. He used to be much better before."
"What do you mean by before?"
"Before Mother died."
"Then it was you brought him food and drink, Nelly?"
"Yes, I used to."
"Where did you get it? From Madame Bubnov?"
"No, I never took anything from Bubnov,"
she said emphatically with a shaking voice. "Where did you get it? You had nothing, had you?" Nelly turned fearfully pale and said nothing. She bent a long, long look upon me.
"I used to beg in the streets. When I had 5 kopecks, I used to buy him bread and snuff."
"And he let you, Nelly? Nelly?"
"At first I did it without telling him. But when he found out, he used to send me out himself. I used to stand on the bridge and beg of passers-by, and he used to walk up and down near the bridge, and when he saw me given anything, he used to rush at me and take the money, as though I wanted to hide it from him and were not getting it for him."
As she said this, she smiled a sarcastic, bitter smile.
"That was all when Mother was dead,"
she added.
"Then he seemed to have gone quite out of his mind."
"So he must have loved your mother very much. How was it he didn't live with her?"
"No, he didn't love her. He was wicked and didn't forgive her, like that wicked old man yesterday,"
she said quietly, almost in a whisper, and grew paler and paler. I started. The plot of a whole drama seemed to flash before my eyes. That poor woman dying in a cellar at the coffin maker's, her orphan child who visited from time to time the old grandfather who had cursed her mother, the queer, crazy old fellow who had been dying in the confectioner's shop after his dog's death.
"And Azorka used to be Mother's dog,"
said Nelly suddenly, smiling at some reminiscence.
"Grandfather used to be very fond of Mother once, and when Mother went away from him, she left Azorka behind. And that's why he was so fond of Azorka. He didn't forgive Mother, but when the dog died, he died too,"
Nelly added harshly, and the smile vanished from her face. "What was he in old days, Nelly?" I asked her after a brief pause.
"He used to be rich. I don't know what he was,"
she answered.
"He had some sort of factory. So Mother told me. At first she used to think I was too little and didn't tell me everything. She used to kiss me and say, 'You'll know everything. The time will come when you'll know everything, poor unhappy child.' She was always calling me poor and unhappy. And sometimes at night, when she thought I was asleep, though I was only pretending to be asleep on purpose, she used to be always crying over me. She would kiss me and say, 'Poor unhappy child.'"
"What did your mother die of?"
"Of consumption. It's 6 weeks ago."
"And you do remember the time when your grandfather was rich?"
"But I wasn't born then. Mother went away from grandfather before I was born."
"With whom did she go?"
"I don't know,"
said Nelly softly, as though hesitating.
"She went abroad, and I was born there."
"Abroad? Where?"
"In Switzerland. I've been everywhere. I've been in Italy and in Paris, too."
I was surprised. "And do you remember it at all, Nelly?"
"I remember a great deal."
"How is it you know Russian so well, Nelly?"
"Mother used to teach me Russian even then. She was Russian because her mother was Russian. But grandfather was English, but he was just like a Russian, too. And when we came to Russia 1.5 years ago, I learnt it thoroughly. Mother was ill even then. Then we got poorer and poorer. Mother was always crying. At first she was a long time looking for Grandfather here in Petersburg, and always crying and saying that she had behaved badly to him. How she used to cry! And when she knew Grandfather was poor, she cried more than ever. She often wrote letters to him, and he never answered.
Why did your mother come back here? Was it only to see her father?
I don't know, but there we were so happy.
And Nellie's eyes sparkled.
Mother used to live alone with me. She had one friend, a kind man like you. He used to know her before she went away, but he died out there, and Mother came back.
So it was with him that your mother went away from your grandfather?
No, not with him. Mother went away with someone else, and he left her.
Who was he, Nellie? Nellie glanced at me and said nothing. She evidently knew the name of the man with whom her mother had gone away and who was probably her father. It was painful to her to speak that name, even to me. I did not want to worry her with questions. Hers was a strange character, nervous and fiery, though she suppressed her impulses, lovable, though she entrenched herself behind a barrier of pride and reserve. Although she loved me with her whole heart, with the most candid and ingenuous love, almost as she had loved the dead mother of whom she could not speak without pain, yet all the while I knew her she was rarely open with me, and except on that day she rarely felt moved to speak to me of her past. On the contrary, she was, as it were, austerely reserved with me. But on that day, through convulsive sobs of misery that interrupted her story, she told me in the course of several hours all that most distressed and tortured her in her memories, and I shall never forget that terrible story, but the greater part of it will be told later. It was a fearful story. It was the story of a woman abandoned and living on after the wreck of her happiness, sick, worn out, and forsaken by everyone. Rejected by the last creature to whom she could look, her father, once wronged by her and crazed by intolerable sufferings and humiliations. It was the story of a woman driven to despair, wandering through the cold, filthy streets of Petersburg, begging alms with the little girl whom she regarded as a baby, of a woman who lay dying for months in a damp cellar, while her father, refusing to forgive her to the last moment of her life, and only at the last moment relenting, hastened to forgive her only to find a cold corpse instead of the woman he loved above everything on earth. It was a strange story of the mysterious, hardly comprehensible relations of the crazy old man with the little grandchild who already understood him, who already, child as she was, understood many things that some men do not attain to in long years of their smooth and carefully guarded lives. It was a gloomy story, one of those gloomy and distressing dramas which are so often played out unseen, almost mysterious under the heavy sky of Petersburg, in the dark, secret corners of the vast town, in the midst of the giddy ferment of life, of dull egoism, of clashing interests, of gloomy vice and secret crimes in that lowest hell of senseless and abnormal life. But that story will be told later. Part 3, Chapter 1. Twilight had fallen. The evening had come on before I roused myself from the gloomy nightmare and came back to the present. "Nellie," I said, "you're ill and upset, and I must leave you alone, in tears and distress. My dear, forgive me, and let me tell you that there's someone else who has been loved and not forgiven, who is unhappy, insulted, and forsaken. She is expecting me, and I feel drawn to her now after your story, so that I can't bear not to see her at once, this very minute." I don't know whether she understood all that I said. I was upset both by her story and by my illness, but I rushed to Natasha's. It was late, 9 o'clock, when I arrived. In the street I noticed a carriage at the gate of the house where Natasha lodged, and I fancied that it was the prince's carriage. The entry was across the courtyard. As soon as I began to mount the stairs, I heard, a flight above me, someone carefully feeling his way, evidently unfamiliar with the place. I imagined this must be the prince, but I soon began to doubt it. The stranger kept grumbling and cursing the stairs as he climbed up, his language growing stronger and more violent as he proceeded. Of course, the staircase was narrow, filthy, steep, and never lighted, but the language I heard on the third floor was such that I could not believe it to be the prince. The ascending gentleman was swearing like a cabman. but there was a glimmer of light on the third floor. A little lamp was burning at Natasha's door. I overtook the stranger at the door, and what was my astonishment when I recognized him as Prince Valkovsky. I fancied he was extremely annoyed at running up against me so unexpectedly. At the first moment he did not recognize me, but suddenly his whole face changed. His first glance of anger and hatred relaxed into an affable, good-humored expression, and he held out both hands to me with extraordinary delight.
"Ah, that's you! And I was just about to kneel down to thank God my life was safe. Did you hear me swearing?"
And he laughed in the most good-natured way. But suddenly his face assumed an earnest and anxious expression.
"How could Alyosha let Natalia Nikolaevna live in such a place?"
he said, shaking his head.
"It's just these so-called trifles that show what a man's made of. I'm anxious about him. He is good-natured, he has a generous heart, but here you have an example. He's frantically in love, yet he puts the girl he loves in a hole like this. I've even heard she has sometimes been short of food,"
he added in a whisper, feeling for the bell handle.
"My head aches when I think about his future, and still more of the future of Anna Nikolaevna when she is his wife."
He used the wrong name and did not notice it in his evident vexation at not finding the bell handle. But there was no bell. I tugged at the door handle, and Mavra at once opened the door to us and met us fussily. In the kitchen, which was divided off from the tiny entry by a wooden screen, through an open door, some preparations could be seen. Everything seemed somehow different from usual, cleaned and polished. There was a fire in the stove and some new crockery on the table. It was evident that we were expected. Mavra flew to help us off with our coats. "Is Alyosha here?" I asked her.
"He has not been,"
she whispered mysteriously. We went in to Natasha. There was no sign of special preparation in her room. Everything was as usual. But everything in her room was always so neat and charming that there was no need to arrange it. Natasha met us, facing the door. I was struck by the wasted look in her face and its extreme pallor, though there was a flush of color for a moment on her wan cheeks. Her eyes were feverish. Hastily she held out her hand to the prince without speaking, visibly confused and agitated. She did not even glance at me. I stood and waited in silence.
"Here I am,"
said the prince with friendly gaiety.
"I've only been back a few hours. You've never been out of my mind all these days."
He kissed her hand tenderly.
"And how much I have thought about you. How much I have thought of to say to you. Well, we can talk to our heart's content. In the first place, my feather-headed youngster, who is not here yet—"
"Excuse me, prince,"
Natasha interrupted, flushing and embarrassed.
"I have to say a word to Ivan Petrovich. Vanya, come along. Two words."
She seized my hand and drew me behind the screen.
"Vanya,"
she said in a whisper, leading me to the furthest corner.
"Will you forgive me?"
"Hush, Natasha, what do you mean?"
No, Vanya, you have forgiven me too much and too often. But there's an end to all patience. You will never leave off caring for me, I know. But you'll call me ungrateful. And I was ungrateful to you yesterday, and the day before yesterday. Selfish, cruel."
She suddenly burst into tears and pressed her face on my shoulder.
"Hush, Natasha,"
I hastened to reassure her. "I've been very ill all night, and I can hardly stand now. That's why I didn't come yesterday or today, and you've been thinking I was angry. Dearest, do you suppose I don't understand what's going on in your heart now?"
"Well, that's right, then. Then you've forgiven me, as you always do,"
she said, smiling through her tears and squeezing my hand till it hurt.
"The rest later. I've a lot I must say to you, Vanya. But now, come back to him."
"Make haste, Natasha. We left him so suddenly."
You'll see what's coming directly,"
she whispered to me.
"Now I understand it all. I see through it all. It's all his doing. A great deal will be decided this evening. Come along."
I didn't understand, but there was no time to ask. Natasha came up to the prince with a serene expression. He was still standing with his hat in his hand. She apologized good-humoredly, took his hat from him, moved up a chair for him, and we three sat down round her little table.
"I was beginning about my feather-headed boy,"
the prince went on.
"I've only seen him for a moment, and that was in the street when he was getting into his carriage to drive to the Countess Zinaida Fyodorovna. He was in a terrible hurry and, would you believe it, wouldn't even stop to come to my room. After 4 days of absence, and I believe it's my fault, Natalia Nikolaevna, that he's not here and that we've arrived before him. I seized the chance. As I couldn't be at the Countess's myself today, I gave him a message to her. But he will be here in a minute or two.
I suppose he promised you to come today?
Asked Natasha, looking at the prince with a look of perfect simplicity.
Good heavens, as though he wouldn't have come anyway. How can you ask?
He exclaimed, looking at her in wonder.
I understand, though, you are angry with him. Indeed, it does seem wrong of him to be the last to come. But I repeat that it's my fault. Don't be angry with him. He's shallow, frivolous. I don't defend him, but certain special circumstances make it necessary that he should not give up the Countess and some other connections, but, on the contrary, should go to see them as often as possible. And as now he never leaves your side, I expect, and has forgotten everything else on earth, please do not be angry if I sometimes take him off for an hour or two, not more, to do things for me. I dare say he has not been to see Princess A once since that evening, and I'm vexed that I have not had time to question him yet.
I glanced towards Natasha. She was listening to Prince Valkovsky with a slight, half-mocking smile. But he spoke so frankly, so naturally. It seemed impossible to suspect him.
And did you really not know that he has not been near me all these days?
Asked Natasha in a quiet and gentle voice, as though she were talking of the most ordinary matter.
What? Not been here once? Good heavens, what are you saying?
Said the prince, apparently in extreme astonishment.
You were with me late on Tuesday evening. Next morning he came in to see me for half an hour, and I've not seen him once since then.
But that's incredible.
He was more and more astonished.
I expected that he would never leave your side. Excuse me, this is so strange. It's simply beyond belief.
But it's true, though, and I'm so sorry. I was looking forward to seeing you. I was expecting to learn from you where he has been.
Upon my soul. But he'll be here directly. But what you tell me is such a surprise to me that, I confess, I was prepared for anything from him but this.
How it surprises you. While I thought that, so far from being surprised, you knew beforehand that it would be so.
Knew? I? But I assure you, Natalia Nikolaevna, that I've only seen him for one moment today, and I've questioned no one about him. And it strikes me as odd that you don't seem to believe me.
He went on, scanning us both.
God forbid,
Natasha exclaimed.
I'm quite convinced that what you say is true.
And she laughed again, right in Prince Valkovsky's face, so that he almost winced.
Explain yourself,
he said in confusion.
Why, there's nothing to explain. I speak very simply. You know how heedless and forgetful he is, and now that he has been given complete liberty, he is carried away.
But to be carried away like that is impossible. There's something behind it, and as soon as he comes in, I'll make him explain what it is. But what surprises me most of all is that you seem to think me somehow to blame, when I've not even been here. But I see, Natalia Nikolaevna, that you are very angry with him, and I can quite understand. You've every right to be so, and of course I'm the first person to blame, if only that I'm the first to turn up. That's how it is, isn't it?
He went on, turning to me with angry derision. Natasha flushed red.
Certainly, Natalia Nikolaevna,
he continued with dignity.
I'll admit I am to blame, but only for going away the day after I made your acquaintance. So, with the suspiciousness of character I observe in you, you have already changed your opinion of me. Circumstances, of course, have given some grounds for this. Had I not gone away, you would have known me better, and Alyosha would not have been so heedless with me to look after him. You shall hear yourself what I say to him this evening.
That is, you'll manage to make him begin to feel me a burden. Surely, with your cleverness, you can't imagine that that would be any help to me.
Do you mean to hint that I would intentionally try to make him feel you a burden? You insult me, Natalia Nikolaevna.
I try to speak without hints when I can, whoever the person may be I am speaking to,
answered Natasha.
I always try, on the contrary, to be as open as I can, and you will perhaps be convinced of that this evening. I don't wish to insult you, and there's no reason I should, if only because you won't be insulted by my words, whatever I may say. Of that I am quite certain, for I quite realize the relation in which we stand to one another. You can't take it seriously, can you? But if I really have been rude to you, I am ready to ask your pardon, that I may not be lacking in any of the obligations of hospitality.
In spite of the light and even jesting tone with which she uttered these words and the smile on her lips, I had never seen Natasha so intensely irritated. It was only now that I realized what her heartache must have been during those 3 days. Her enigmatic saying that she knew everything now and that she guessed it all frightened me. It referred directly to Prince Valkovsky. She had changed her opinion of him and looked upon him as her enemy. That was evident. She apparently attributed her discomfiture with Alyosha to his influence, and had perhaps some grounds for this belief. I was afraid there might be a scene between them at any moment. Her mocking tone was too manifest, too undisguised. Her last words to the prince that he could not take their relations seriously, the phrase about the obligations of hospitality, her promise that looked like a threat to show him that she knew how to be open, all this was so biting, so unmistakable, that it was impossible that the prince should not understand it. I saw his face change, but he was well able to control himself. He at once pretended not to have noticed these words, not to have seen their significance, and took refuge course in raillery.
"God forbid I should ask for apologies," he cried, laughing. "That's not at all what I wanted, and indeed it's against my rules to ask apologies from a woman. At our first interview I warned you what I was like, so you're not likely to be angry with me for one observation, especially as it applies to all women. You probably agree with this remark,"
he went on, politely turning to me.
"I have noticed as a trait in the female character that if woman is in fault in any way, she will sooner smooth over her offence with a 1,000 caresses later on than admit her fault and ask forgiveness at the moment when she is confronted with it. And so, supposing even that I have been insulted by you, I am not anxious for an apology. It will be all the better for me later on when you own your mistake and want to make it up to me, with a 1,000 caresses. And you are so sweet, so pure, so fresh, so open, that the moment of your penitence will, I foresee, be enchanting. You had better, instead of apologizing, tell me now whether I cannot do something this evening to show you that I am behaving much more sincerely and straightforwardly than you suppose."
Natasha flushed. I, too, fancied that there was somewhat too flippant, even too casual a tone in Prince Valkovsky's answer, a rather unseemly jocosity.
"You want to prove that you are simple and straightforward with me?"
asked Natasha, looking at him with a challenging air.
"Yes."
"If so, do what I ask."
"I promise beforehand."
"And that is, not by one word, one hint, to worry Alyosha about me, either today or tomorrow. No reproof for having forgotten me. No remonstrance. I want to meet him as though nothing had happened, so that he may notice nothing. That's what I want. Will you make me such a promise?"
"With the greatest pleasure,"
answered Prince Valkovsky,
"and allow me to add with all my heart that I have rarely met more sensible and clear-sighted attitude in such circumstances. But I believe this is Alyosha."
A sound was in fact heard in the passage. Natasha started and seemed to prepare herself for something. Prince Valkovsky sat with a serious face, waiting to see what would happen. He watched Natasha intently. But the door opened, and Alyosha flew in. Chapter 2. He literally flew in with a beaming face, gay and joyous. It was evident that he had spent those 4 days gaily and happily. One could see from his face that he had something he was longing to tell us.
"Here I am,"
he cried out, addressing us all.
"I who ought to have been here before anyone. But I'll tell you everything directly. Everything. Everything. I hadn't time to say 2 words to you this morning, Daddy, and I had so much to say to you. It's only in his sweet moments he lets me speak to him like that,"
he interrupted himself, addressing me.
"I assure you at other times he forbids it. And I'll tell you what he does. He begins to use my full name. But from this day I want him always to have good minutes, and I shall manage it. I've become quite a different person in these last 4 days, utterly, utterly different, and I'll tell you all about it. But that will be presently. The great thing now is that she's here. Here she is. Again, Natasha, darling, how are you, my angel?"
he said, sitting down beside her and greedily kissing her hand.
"How I've been missing you all this time. But there it is. I couldn't help it. I wasn't able to manage it, my darling. You look a little thinner. You've grown so pale."
He rapturously covered her hands with kisses and looked eagerly at her with his beautiful eyes, as though he could never look enough. I glanced at Natasha, and from her face I guessed that our thoughts were the same. He was absolutely innocent. And indeed, when and how could this innocent be to blame? A bright flush suddenly overspread Natasha's pale cheeks, as though all the blood had suddenly rushed from her heart to her head. Her eyes flashed, and she looked proudly at Prince Valkovsky.
"But where have you been so many days?"
she said in a suppressed and breaking tone. She was breathing in hard, uneven gasps. My God, how she loved him!
"To be sure, I must have seemed to blame, and it's not only seeming, indeed. Of course, I've been to blame, and I know it myself, and I've come knowing it. Katya told me yesterday, today, that no woman could forgive such negligence. She knows all that happened here on Tuesday. I told her next day. I argued with her. I maintained that there is such a woman, and her name is Natasha, and that perhaps there was only one other woman equal to her in the world, and that was Katya. And I came here, of course, knowing I'd won the day. Could an angel like you refuse to forgive? He's not come, so something must have kept him. It's not that he doesn't love me. That's what my Natasha will think. As though one could leave off loving you. As though it were possible. My whole heart has been aching for you. I'm to blame all the same. But when you know all about it, you'll be the first to stand up for me. I'll tell you all about it directly. I want to open my heart to you all. That's what I've come for. I wanted to fly to you today. I was free for half a minute, to give you a flying kiss, but I didn't succeed even in that. Katya sent for me on important business. That was before you saw me in the carriage, Father. That was the second time I was driving to Katya after a second note. Messengers are running all day long with notes between the two houses. Ivan Petrovich, I only had time to read your note last night, and you are quite right in all you say in it. But what could I do? It was a physical impossibility. And so I thought, tomorrow evening,